Hello. You have a collect call from...
That's...
So, Cincinnati.
Will you accept the charges?
All right, welcome into another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I feel like I'm yelling right now because we are actually all calling in on the phone. We're doing this via our iPhone recording. We're trying something new. Hey, we're there for you. We've had to adjust some logistics, but we are in full social distancing mode. And I'd like to welcome in my co-host from the Delhi Bureau, Sherry Coolidge.
Direct from the yellow guest room.
Direct from the yellow guest room. And Silent Phil is also on here, but he's silent. So Silent Phil is probably nodding his head right now, agreeing that he is with us.
Jason,
Sherry, we're back.
I miss you.
What's that?
I miss you.
Miss you guys. We have Senator Rob Portman on today as our special guest, talking about him working with the White House on COVID-19, some things that he's done here in Ohio to try to clear some regulations for some companies to get ventilators to hospitals, and working with Battelle in Columbus on their mask cleaning stuff. And he also is donating a portion of his salary at this time, as people are taking pay cuts and unfortunately getting furloughed and laid off in some cases to charity. So looking forward to talking to him about that. Ask him about, you know, has he been working with Trump directly at this time, and how that's going, Sherry. But first, I mean, with this whole new world, I think a lot of things got rocked starting right out of the gate this week. On Monday is when a lot of companies, a lot of organizations, government organizations started to announce we're feeling the pinch and we're going to have to start to furlough and in some cases lay people off. And that has been the case in the city of Cincinnati, unfortunately. Sherry, you've been all over this. You broke the story yesterday, which you had all the breakdown of the 1,700 city employees. What take it from there, and what's going on at City Hall, and what's the future look like?
You know, it's been a really tough week over there. So on Monday, the city manager and the mayor had a press conference where they talked about the idea that they were going to have to lay off 17, not lay off. We're using the word furloughs. They use the words temporary layoff. These are not meant to be permanent. We'll talk about that in a second. So let's use the word furlough. And I had like a big long discussion about what's the best word there with editors. And so that number was 1,700, and it was a stunning number. And I have to say the mayor was very upset and choked up. And a lot of people, that was like a moment a lot of people have been talking about. You know, I think it was genuine. And when you know these people and they work in your office, like two of the 1,700, you know, directly work in his very small mayoral office, the city manager's office, you know, more than that. They had to tell people that they were their friends. And the city manager put it this way, you know, we've gone to their christenings. We're invited to their weddings.
Yeah.
And this is happening. And it was a very emotional moment. And then, so, you know, that was kind of that news when that came out. And then after that, to see the actual list, you're scrolling down a database. It was just awful feeling, awful to see all of those names. I know some of them. And so it's been a very hard week at City Hall.
Yes. Good.
Not a lot of choice though. You know, they're just facing this plummeting budget related to the coronavirus.
And let's, for the listeners, for the upcoming budget year, which begins July 1, there's a potential $80 million budget deficit coming up for that one. But even now in the current budget year, there's also an additional deficit they're facing now. Is that
right?
Correct?
The second, it's a 27.5 million dollar deficit. Get us through the end of the year. So those cuts had to happen immediately because they're literally in that cycle right now.
To get through the end of the fiscal year, which ends June 30th.
Yes.
Correct. Okay. So essentially right now, the city over the next, what, 15 months is facing over, oh, I guess, what, yeah, over 100, 107 million-ish potentially budget.
No one should ever ask us to do math. Come on, Jay.
Right. 27 plus 80 is carry the one. No. So, yeah, over 107, potentially $107 million budget deficit for the next, what, 15 months. Is that unheard of?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is an absolute, for every, not us, every government, you know. And I'm assigned to cover City Hall, but I think next week you can really start to expect me to be looking at our townships. And we have listeners all over, and what this is going to mean for governments all over.
Yeah.
From our very small places, you know, I'm thinking about St. Bernard and Elmwood Place. You know, I cover the county for a while, and I know it's very precarious in those small places, but our big governments too, where, you know, in Coleraine and Green, like people are expecting services to be delivered there too. And so we're really going to be taking a hard look at what's going on everywhere. It's not just Cincinnati.
Yeah. That's interesting. You mentioned some of those small little burgs, like, you know, St. Bernard, Elmwood Place, you know, and all, obviously there's a lot of little towns all around the region. I wonder, this is totally just literally thought this popped in my head. You got to wonder if some of these little tiny villages are going to be able really to survive this. That's a question.
Even before this, where we're talking about some of these townships dissolving, you know, the county reporter, Scott Wortman, has been all over Amelia, right?
Yep.
You know, dissolving. That was pre any sort of fiscal issues. And I'm also interested in looking. One of the big issues, this has long been talked about in the city, that 70% of the budget is paid for with the earnings tax. And we're very lucky in that way because we have Kroger and Procter and Gamble and like these big companies that, mm-hmm. you know, pay into that. But then we're very dependent on them, mm-hmm. right, for any sort of, you know, shift. Like with Macy's, I think they said when Macy's closed their Cincinnati headquarters, I think that number was 1.4 million, but I forget the time frame of a loss to the budget. Like those jobs meant something to City of Cincinnati services. And so we'll be looking at what that means too. The budget suddenly becomes very granular and less about, you know, the streetcar and I hate to say like affordable housing. That was my last normal story.
That's right.
When I did normal interviews and everything was like, that was the conversation, eviction prevention and affordable housing.
Yep.
And like suddenly we've shifted into crisis mode and it's hard to imagine like writing about, well, what does affordable housing look like in the city? And it's no less important.
Yep.
But now it's really going to be like where this money comes from and the losses and how they're going to continue to provide basic services, which, of course, I'm not suggesting that they're not going to. The mayor has promised that. There's a whole line of credit to make sure that still happens. But it's going to really just prompt this whole new look of like how we're going to get out of this and be the growing city that John Cranley has been touting, you know, in the last few years here.
Do you see in you know, I saw you just had this great piece, you had a really nice scoop yesterday on Cincinnati.com. For those of you who didn't see it, go back and read it. You see the breakdown of all these seven, what departments it's coming from. And for the folks who don't, you know, live in the city, you know, and I know we have several people, but this is why we talk so much about the city, because it's the center of those of us who live in Greater Cincinnati. Many of us work there. Many of us live there. Many of us play there. Do one of the three or all three above, all the above. But you had a piece, and I thought it was interesting. The one part was 166 folks in the police department have been furloughed. None of them have been police officers. And the question it made me think when I saw that is, do you think if things keep going the way they're going, do you see a way where they're going to be able to, you know, avoid laying police officers off, or is it just going to be inevitable they're going to have to do that?
Nobody wants to borrow money to pay for salaries because that's like an ongoing cost.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a line of credit is a very fixed thing.
Yep.
But I can say with absolute certainty and no crystal ball or not even any conversation. We will not be laying off police officers. In fact, the biggest conversation now is keeping the ones we have safe as we see this virus sweeping through police departments. Like, every single person becomes a very critical person, a sworn officer, and the firefighters too, because you have to have them to respond to crime and to these fires. And so, you know, we kind of shift out from there, right? Then water and sewers, you can't let those go. 911, as we've learned the hard way in a terrible, yeah, tragic way, right? That those calls have to go right. And then it becomes this conversation about what you're doing and not doing. But that line of credit is there to make sure those very basic services continue. There cannot be layoffs in those ranks, and make it work with the looming idea of, you know, the virus, you know, impacting, yeah, everyone.
Well, and also, you know,
the actual virus, right? Like, we're talking about money here, but there's actual sickness.
Yeah. And then you also bring in the political aspect of this and the long-term aspect of it as well, because let's, God forbid, let's hope that we're through this in, you know, 2 or 3 more months. Hopefully, you know, and obviously it's going to take a while to ramp back up. So let's just say, you know, by the end of the year that we're really, truly through this, then that's when the political aspect would really kick in, and no one wants to take on and lay off, you know, it's a political, it's a tough thing politically to take on, to lay off police and fire, because those are very powerful unions. And
I honestly, those are important roles to voters. I think that conversation is different now, because that conversation in the past was about, should we be spending that much on public safety?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, more of an esoteric way, like, how are we, yeah, deploying officers? What should we be doing, you know, this thing or that thing in the police department? But right now it's about providing just this basic critical service as we get through all of this. So I think the conversation about laying them off is different than we've ever seen in the past. Nobody's saying, are the forces too large, which has always been the conversation in the past. Everyone, yes, is now saying these responses, and then what if they get sick? And it's like, it is a different conversation.
Yeah. And speaking of, I mean, there was confirmed yesterday, or released yesterday, that a third Cincinnati police officer has tested positive for COVID-19. So yeah, there's no doubt, and these folks are on the front line. And one of my neighbors is a Cincinnati police officer, and you know, he was telling me how challenging it is to try to, you know, approach people and keep your social distance, but still do your job. And you know, and that's a job that you interact with a lot of people. So no doubt, keeping those public safety men and women out there on the streets and is incredibly critical at this time.
And I do think like, another conversation that's coming is like, what does the support for the health department look like? Because I think, and it's hard to know right now, since we're just still kind of at the beginning of things.
Yep.
We're going to live in a world where you're going to need masks, where temperature taking is going to become, you know, some sort of regular thing. Maybe, yes, right? And like, you're hearing this, well, that's going to be, you know, costly to the budget in a whole new way. That's an added cost. That's not even like the cost that we've always had, right? Like, the health,
yeah,
is probably going to need a lot more money. And so, you know, I don't envy anyone that is combing through this budget, but I will say this too. I was sitting there at my kitchen table listening to the budget conversation yesterday.
Yeah.
And I will say, I mean, the people on council right now, as much, you know, critical or whatever text and that, right, you know, they have had experience with the budget. These are people who have been around council for a long time. David Mann particularly is the budget chairman, right?
Mm-hmm.
The mayor, he was the budget chairman when he was a council person, and now he's the mayor. So I do think there's a lot of experience with this budget. And I have always said that the budget director himself is now assistant city manager, Chris Bigham.
Yeah.
Pretty much a magician. Of all the people in City Hall, very few people are able to make everyone happy. And that is just a tough job. And I certainly have not mastered that. And so I've always admired him. And he's just going to be in this seat of trying to balance everything and make everyone happy. And so I have some confidence there that he's at the helm of that.
Good. And in kind of dovetailing off of that, one of the things to try to save money, and is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the mayor said with these furloughs and at least temporary cuts right now, what did he say, $40 million they think they can, they're saving right now? Is that
correct? Out over the year?
I don't know what that looks like, though.
Like, how many people are they going to have to call back, and at what point? And, like, it's still, you know, P.G. Sittenfeld made this question, like, should we be doing this right now? That was the big conversation yesterday, which he had a lot of questions because it was done very hastily, and there were some very upset people inside City Hall about how it was done, and are they essential or are they not? Like, there wasn't time to put the thought in there. So his kind of premise was, like, we need to, you know, think this through a little bit more. And then, but the flip side of that was that the longer you wait, the bigger the cost.
Yes.
Especially because the stimulus bill is there and offering extra unemployment benefits. So they're really using, you know, the stimulus bill as a crutch to help us get through, which is, you know, very smart planning. And so it is a balance there. And that's what it's going to be called upon. But we don't really know what these furloughs mean to the city right now. A lot of health people are on there, and they might have to be called back sooner. And, you know, I honestly, if you look at people in the police department who were furloughed, it's a lot of typists. And it seems like basically all of the support staff, and I find it hard to believe that the police department is really going to be functioning without a support staff.
Yeah.
Like, officers are responding to calls. You know, they're going here, there, and everywhere, and they have to do a lot of things on their own. They're in their own cars. And so it'll be interesting to see. I think you quickly learn, like, well, it seemed like we didn't need that, but we really do. So I think that's going to affect that number.
And one thing also in the decisions that were made at City Hall this week, to try to save money, at least in the short term, was that the streetcar has been shut down.
I think you had a very popular column about that, if we're to believe metrics and the social engagement.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think anyone can question what my opinion is on it, and it's always been consistent since day one, even long before I came to the Inquirer. But, you know, you're talking $5 million a year to operate that thing, another, what, $5 million or so more to service to pay the debt service. Obviously, that's a sunk cost. But shutting it down can, you know, at least right now, potentially get you some savings on the operating cost. I said this is an opportunity, and I don't care. I don't give a damn about the politics. I'm talking about the money. I'm talking about good government. That when you look at the current situation, I can't see that thing reopening, given that it's never met revenue projections. It's never going to. It is a merry-go-round, basically. It just goes in a loop around over the Rhine and mostly empty. I don't see a future for the streetcar. I'm not asking you for your opinion on it, Sherry, but
no, but here are the facts, honestly.
Yeah, and exactly.
Think, you know, and that's how we work best together. You know, I write these news stories and then you columnize on, you know, how you feel about things. But the facts here are going to be, what is the shortfall for the budget this year? Because last year it was 1.4 million. You know, honestly, quite frankly, that's change in the cushions of City Hall. Before all of this, the council voted, you know, to take that out of the operating fund, despite always these long promises that the streetcar will pay for itself with fares and advertising and naming rights. You know, but there was a shortfall last year, and it was $1.4 million in pretty flush budget times. So we're waiting for the streetcar budget now, and I'm very interested to see what it is. I feel like that number is likely going to be more than $1.4 million because, you know, I have ridden the streetcar and the advertising does not seem to be what it needs to be.
Yep.
But
no one wants to touch it.
Well, I mean, I think we have a lot more platforms to advertise too, and like the different ways that people are doing that. And so it'll be interesting. That budget is going to be very important because that's when it's really going to come down to, do we want to spend whatever that shortfall is, if there's a shortfall, let's put that out there, right? Mm-hmm. Compared to, well, there's workers that are furloughed, right? I think this is going to be a very important conversation, especially if you're the workers, you're thinking that, right?
Yep.
And I just, it's almost been kind of unbelievable because in the middle of a pandemic, we're talking about the streetcar.
I know.
But
I know.
we don't really have a choice because it is going to be part of this granular, you know, budget looking of like where every dollar comes from. And honestly, last year when we were reading about it, it did get a lot of attention, this $1.4 million. I know how City Hall works. It is money in couch cushions. I mean, the budget itself is $413 million, the operating budget, but there's, you know, there's all these other, you know, money that flows in different ways and how you pay for things. And mm-hmm. and so I was, you know, I understand that, but that's not the case anymore. We're in the biggest crisis that anyone has ever seen. The mayor said, even, you know, his grandparents haven't seen a crisis like this. He was talking about this at a press conference. And so this is a whole new world. The budget's a whole new thing. And, you know, they're just going to have to go forward. And these discussions are going to be very important of where the priorities lie.
That's right. And when you're looking at it, and $5 million is a nice chunk, a nice one-time line item chunk, when you're talking about $80 million, it's like, and we're also talking about necessity versus luxury. And any objective observer would say that the streetcar, especially right now, is an absolute luxury. And you know, I think you know, longer
this is
term,
where the opinion part comes in. Sorry.
But I think longer, but I mean, but it's public accountability. And
well, that's true, right? And like, and the elected leaders, you know, they're there to do what, you know, the people want. And so and to make the choices that are best for the city and the citizens.
Yeah. Do you see let's fast forward 4 months down the road, however long it is. It's just so weird. Like, we don't know. Who knows? Could be a month, could be a couple weeks, probably more than a couple weeks, could be 6 months. Who knows? Do you see a big streetcar fight looking out on the horizon and a fight over whether to shut it down permanently or to restart it?
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to want to make a decision to shut the streetcar down, you know, permanently. I'm not sure that conversation happens now, because I also don't think this is going to be fixed in 2 seconds. So there's certainly plenty of time to have that conversation. Yesterday,
yes, Tom, I mean, kind of down, and we get down the road, like, but I'm what I'm saying, and I'm not saying one way or the other, but, you know, an answer on it, but I'm just saying, let's say, you know, I don't know, 6 months down the road. I mean, do you see, when we get out beyond this, do you see there being a conversation in council chambers about whether this should be restarted or should be parked for good?
I think that, you know, Vice Mayor Smitherman would really be pushing that conversation. There's already been some communications. We're waiting for the Federal Transit Authority to kind of weigh in about whether it can even be temporarily stopped. You know, any kind of communication with them kind of opens the door for that. So those responses, you know, it's not like it's a dormant issue. There are still people pushing for that and conversations happening. So I do feel like this is going to be pushed into a very public conversation.
Yeah.
If not right now in like this crisis moment, right? But like as they're trying to fix real budgets, maybe not this year, but next year.
Well, I'm glad as we record here on a beautiful Thursday morning, there was a very, very long budget committee yesterday. And a lot of hand wringing, a lot of sausage making, a lot of discussions. But the one thing I think was encouraging was that no one went down that streetcar rabbit hole. And you know what? Kudos to this council and the mayor for, you know, putting that political football aside for now, and you know, putting that off for another day when we get beyond the health crisis here.
Definitely. We might be reopened now with some conversations about should it run with a skeleton crew or not, but there definitely was no fighting over it yesterday.
Yeah.
They were very focused on people and workers and services, which is where it should have been.
Anything else you can think of that really came out of, you know, city hall or even city government this week. I mean, and we had, you know, Denise Driehaus was just on her press conference right before we jumped on our recording here, you know, talking about the two deaths in Hamilton County and choked up and really liked what she was doing. By the way, you know, she's not getting a lot of credit right now, but I think she's doing a great job. And she had both Gwen McFarland, the Democratic Party chair, and Alex Ciantofalou, the GOP chair, in her press conference today to discuss the voting process now. And because, believe it or not, I know it's hard to believe, but we actually still have a primary going, and it's a vote by mail primary in Hamilton County, or actually all over the state, up to April 28th. So is there anything else you can think of that has happened this week in local government that you know, comes to mind?
You know, I think less newsy and more on the side of like Denise choking up and John choking up with the furloughs and being upset. It has shown really the human side of everybody.
Yep.
They're tired, first of all. You know, they've been working around the clock. I know, like, if you try and call them and like they're working at all hours and they're doing very tough things. I mean, to see the photos come out of the convention center with the National Guard standing there and looking at turning it into a hospital.
You know,
the mayor called it a holy moly moment. And I was like, that's what I feel like when I see that. And he was in it, and I'm only looking at it on Twitter. And so it's like, this is the human side of things. And, you know, these really hard decisions about people and keeping people well. And it's, you know, I think it's okay to show everybody's human side. And that's, we're seeing it.
Well, and two, and not this isn't a political thing, but it's an experience thing. And I tweeted this. I don't know. We've talked so much about Mike DeWine, and obviously we had him. By the way, if you missed that episode, folks, that we had Governor Mike DeWine on the podcast last week. So go back and check that out. We've talked about Mike DeWine, but I also think here locally, John Cranley and Commissioner Denise Driehaus have both been really strong, steady leaders. And my point is that I think there's something to be said for experience. And I know Cranley talked about that on the podcast two episodes ago. But both of those politicians have had a lot of experience in public office. And, you know,
and Denise having all that experience up at the state, like
that kind
of thing is helpful. And now, and John knows about all the budget, and he's just really been like deep in every part of this city. Like, experience does matter. And we talked about that with the governor. He
That's
has
right.
all kind of experience, even in his, you know, private life, funding a school in Haiti and all of the public health things. This is when you look and you're like, okay, experience.
Absolutely. Speaking of, let's our special guest this week again is Senator Rob Portman, and actually, as we were sitting here recording, I got a press release that came over again from him and some other things that he's doing. So let's bring him on the teleconference, the podcast teleconference, and discuss all that's going on right now. Well, I'm pleased to welcome in on our special guest on the That's the Cincinnati podcast. I know we've tried before, and it's an honor to welcome Senator Rob Portman from right here in Cincinnati. Senator Portman, how you doing?
Jason, I'm okay, and I appreciate both you and Sherry and what you guys are doing every day to get the word out to people to help them through this coronavirus crisis.
Well, thank you. And back at you. You've been very busy, and you and I talked a little bit yesterday about a lot of the things that you're working on right now. And let's jump right to it. You had a release this week, and we did a story on it that you stepped in and helped UC Health get an expedited order for ventilators. Can you talk about that and the process of helping to get that moving on and what that means and ultimately, you know, the importance of that?
Yeah. Well, we're doing this around the state, trying to help companies, and in some cases, like Battelle in Columbus, a nonprofit, in some cases, the state, you know, free things up at the federal level. University of Cincinnati is looked to as the premier academic hospital here in town, and therefore, you know, leading on the testing. But until now, they've only been able to test about 80 to 100 people a day, which is not nearly enough. You know, we need more testing. And unless you're really sick in Cincinnati, it's tough to get testing. So I think that's the key, frankly, to helping solve the healthcare crisis here, because you need to be able to test. And then, you know, they say contact trace people. I just got off the phone with Dr. Fauci, who we've all gotten to know through his briefings, but he believes that too. We've got to have more testing. So UC contacted me about 10 days ago and said that they had a machine on order to be able to greatly expand their testing by more than 10 times. And it was a state-of-the-art machine, and the company wasn't willing to send it. Despite the contract they had, they were supposed to get it a couple weeks ago. You know, they weren't getting it. And so we got engaged and involved because the company was pointing the finger at the White House and at the HHS, Health and Human Services Department. So we went to the White House. I spoke to the White House directly, but also worked with the Assistant Secretary at HHS, who was responsible for this area, and made our case. We need more testing in greater Cincinnati. And lo and behold, the machine is now on its way. It may arrive today. It may arrive tomorrow. It may arrive over the weekend. But UC is ready for it. Immediately, day before yesterday, you know, when we got a decision that they would move ahead with it, they also sent their inspectors in. This is the company is called Roche, R-O-C-H-E. It's a Swiss company. And it would be fantastic to have this machine. It not only is state-of-the-art in terms of its accuracy, which is important because you want to have, you know, most accurate tests possible, but it also is quick. So within 8 or 9 hours, you should be able to get your results. And it'll be working 24/7. So this is a nice accomplishment for our community, because without more testing, Jason, I don't know how we ever can stop this spread.
Well, I mean, I absolutely. And I was reading a note here that this machine that you've helped to expedite UC to get and clear all the bureaucratic hurdles with the White House, or, you know, the federal the FDA, can produce 1,000 test results a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and when we're hearing, you know, the people are talking about 4 or 5 days of getting their test results back, this is huge.
Yeah, it really is. I've got a buddy who clearly has coronavirus, but he doesn't know for sure yet because he's waiting for his test to come back. And it's actually been 4 or 5 days already. He still doesn't have it. He's one of these people who was sick enough that, you know, it was on the verge of hospitalization, and they let him get a test. By the way, he tried for a week to get one. He couldn't get one. So it's not up to where it should be yet. But once this test is in place, and then other tests will come online. As I understand it, there's some new tests out there that are really fast, where you can get a result in a matter of a few hours. That's going to help a lot, because we got to know who's got the disease, and we got to know who they've been in touch with, so you can, as Dr. Fauci said today, you know, trace the contacts, and then get those people isolated. That's how countries like South Korea got a hold of this thing. They just said, hey, drive through testing. Anybody wants it can get it. It's free. That's what we've got to have in this country too.
Sherry, I know we're not sitting across from each other to nod.
I have to ask, this is a very important conversation, but what is Dr. Fauci like? Did you know him before this, or are these your first conversations with him? I mean, you know, would ever think like a medical, you know, person would be the star, right? And like these press conferences every single day. So tell me, what is that like?
Yeah, he's kind of an unlikely star, isn't he? But I've known him over the years because he's been kind of the person. I think he's been in something like, you know, 200 four administrations, whatever. But he's been there for a long time. He's 79 years old. And he gave us a briefing about, I'd say, a month and a half ago. I've gone to every one of his briefings on Capitol Hill when we were in session. And I went up to him afterwards. I said, you know, I'm praying for you. And he kind of looked at me. I don't think he'd heard that from many people. And I said, because you're so reassuring. You are so capable with your experience and your knowledge and your style. You know, he's just calm. And, you know, he gives you a sense of confidence. And I said, you got to stay healthy, man. We need you. And we actually walked out of the conference that day together, and I had a chance to talk to him more about what was going on in Ohio. And again, he made the point to me early on, Rob, we got to have the ability to know what's going on by having more testing. So all this is important. The PPE is important because the people who are testing you know, ought to have protective gear on. We got to have the ventilators for people who end up in the hospitals and are really sick and need something to breathe for them. That's what the ventilator does. And we're working on all that. We've had some successes here in Ohio recently on that too, on getting Cardinal Health to get 2.2 million gowns out yesterday. There's two companies in Ohio that want to make ventilators. We're working on that with the White House. We got a bunch of masks to be recycled up at Battelle. We got that approved about 3 days ago. So we're working on all that. But ultimately, I believe, Jerry, unless you get this testing going, and that's where Dr. Fauci is. He also, by the way, was a basketball player in high school. He was, you know, he's, I don't know, if he's 5'7", that's probably exaggerated on the program. You know, he's a short guy, but he was a great little basketball player, a guard. And he's a feisty guy and a competitive guy, but we need him right now.
And he worked for George H.W. Bush, right? That's when he first, was that the first administration he worked for?
Okay. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I may have met him back then because I worked in the Bush White House for first Bush.
Yeah.
But yeah, the guy's got all kinds of experience, and he's been through the bird flu and the swine flu and, other Ebola crises. I mean, he's been through it all, the AIDS epidemic. So he has a good feel for not just what happens here in this country, but globally. One of the things that would have helped a whole lot in this crisis from talking to him and other experts is if China had told us what was going on. You know, they didn't tell their own people. They also didn't tell us. And that's made this problem worse than it would otherwise be, because, you know, it was clear this was highly contagious and it was going to be moving through communities. And, you know, if they had informed the World Health Organization and gotten every country involved earlier on, we'd be in better shape.
I want to ask you, so it was such a high profile thing this past weekend with Battelle and the FDA and the regulations and Governor Mike DeWine, in a very un-Mike DeWine way, was pretty pointed in his criticism. What role did you play in helping to get that cleared up? And now the FDA is all in with Battelle, a Columbus-based company, to do this mask sanitation work. What role did you, without getting too far in the weeds, like how are you able to step in there and help, get this thing moving?
Well, I was working with Governor DeWine. He called me actually early Sunday morning, very early Sunday morning, and said, I'm thinking of doing this, sending out this release. I'm mad at FDA for not approving Battelle to clean more than 10,000 masks a day, because that's what the approval for.
Yeah,
they could do up to 160,000 a day with two machines, 80,000 each. And so, of course, I jumped in. I called the FDA. I called the White House and tried to be helpful. But honestly, it was a miscommunication in large part because the application was not clear. And so it was kind of like one of these things where you kind of had to just cut through all the BS and find out what the real issue was and then say, okay, you've approved the technology. I mean, if you're approving 10,000, why can't you approve, a million, much less 160,000? And they agreed and it got done. But, the bureaucracy moves at a glacial pace under normal circumstances. And sometimes there's reasons for that. Like at the FDA, you want things to be safe, right? We don't want to have stuff on the shelves that is going to harm us. But in a crisis like this, as I told my staff this morning in our conference call, we have one every morning first thing, we go through all of our projects we're working on all around the state, including implementing this new federal law. But I said, this is like a wartime footing. None of the old rules apply here. So you got to go right to the top. You got to, I called the U.S. Trade Representative this morning as an example. His name is Bob Lighthizer, because Purell, which is a company in Ohio, people don't know that largely, but Purell, hand sanitizer, leading global leader, is in Ohio. They're having trouble getting some product in, and they have a 25% tariff on some of the necessary product. So we're trying to get that waived so we can get more Purell on the shelves. And so you call him directly, and he didn't know about it. Of course, his staff had been working with our staff on it the last couple of days, but he sometimes have to go right to the top, and he got it right away and said, look, I get it. We're gonna try to fix this thing. And I suspect, we'll fix that today, I hope. If not today, in the next couple of days.
Does that directly help Ohioans? Because I know we just wrote a story about Procter & Gamble, who's kind of ramping up hand sanitizer under their brand Safeguard. Do those things actually help Ohioans more because we're so lucky to have these things here? Or is it just, they pump it out for national consumption?
I think both, Sherry. I really do. Procter & Gamble, as an example, by the way, is making some of this hand sanitizer in Ohio. So their Lima plant, as I understand it, I talked to their CEO this week about that, and we're trying to help them to be sure, you know, they're getting through any hurdles that they have. They're also doing some great things with facial masks. They're using it for their own workforce, so they're back and continue, but they're also donating hundreds of thousands of those to people on the front lines. They're also looking at other ways to help. I'm not sure they've announced it yet, but in addition to hand sanitizers and the masks, so they're on it.
Who do you want to say what ways?
Helping
our audience is very concerned about all these products. Do you know of anything else they're trying to do?
Well, I think they'd like to look at everything: ventilators, face masks, and you know, they just want to be sure that you know, they are able to produce it and produce it in volumes and to make sure that it's something that's needed. So they're looking partly to people like me to say, find out, you know, help us find out from the feds, what are the priorities here and, you know, where do they need to go? But I think it does help Ohio because, you know, Purell being in Ohio, by the way, they're creating a lot of jobs at Purell, right? They're 24/7, they're expanding their capability best they can. And that, you know, is giving Ohioans in Northeast Ohio in particular, where they're located, opportunities. Chagrin Falls is, for instance, where one of their big factories is, and they're just going, you know, great guns. They're producing all they possibly can. And look, it's a national crisis. I think Ohio has done the right thing in taking this very seriously. I commend Governor DeWine and his team for saying early on, you know what, we're gonna risk a major healthcare crisis here unless we take some tough steps now. And those tough steps included, you know, closing down restaurants and bars and telling people they can't go to school and, you know, stuff that was not very popular. We were one of the first states to do those things. Now, almost every state is doing that. And I think that was necessary because unless you can get people into a situation where there is social distancing, as they call it, and stay at home and using the sanitizer and so on, it's very difficult to get hold of this thing. And again, testing is also critical because you can do all those things, and if you're not testing, you don't know what the situation is. You don't know who's being exposed, and maybe therefore exposing other people inadvertently. So,
yeah,
I think we did the right thing, Sherry, by being a little more proactive. And thank goodness we got these great Ohio companies that are able to help on, you know, the PPE and help on the ventilators and help to ensure, you know, that the whole country is better off.
Do you another thing, you decided to give up your salary for April and May through the end of May. What went into that decision? And I know you're actually donating your salary the next 2 months to organizations and funds across the state of Ohio. I think it's with 5 or 6 different organizations that are helping them to then help combat the COVID-19 crisis. What went into that decision? Yeah. And
it's a token amount, and it's just, you know, I just wanted to try to do something small to help. But mostly I did it because, to be honest with you, I was starting to hear from people, including, you know, friends of mine who have lost their jobs.
Yeah.
And they don't have any paycheck coming in. You know, they've lost their hourly wages, or in some cases lost their salary. I know some small businesses that have shut down, particularly in the restaurant business, just in bars. They're just closed. They can make it work with delivery and pickup. So, you know, a lot of people are suffering right now, and I'm in a position to be able to do it. And I also did it because I wanted to hold up these nonprofits that are doing a great job. There's 5 of them around the state. The one in the Great Cincinnati area I chose was our Greater Cincinnati Foundation, in conjunction with United Way, as a COVID-19 fund that's helping other nonprofits. So I put all that information out there and said, hey, this is what I'm doing. Here's the button to say donate on all these groups. But look in your own community. Find out, you know, who you think's doing the best job. They need help right now because they're kind of filling the gaps. You know, people ask me about, you know, who's taking care of these kids that aren't getting their school lunches. Well, there's money in the bill for that, but it takes a while for all that to work. So in the meantime, these nonprofits, the food banks, are stepping up. You know, who's taking care of the homeless? You know, they shouldn't be out there without, you know, social distancing and all this as well. And, well, nonprofits are stepping in to do a lot of that. So there's a lot of instances where the nonprofits are filling the gap right now, and yet they're seeing their contributions go down as people, are having a tough time. But if you can, and many people can't, I get that. But if you can do a little more for others right now, doing it through a good nonprofit's a way to help, a way for everybody to be involved. It's also tough to volunteer right now. There are always some ways to volunteer on the phone. And you know, if you've already gone through this and you think you have the immunity, that would help. One thing I can't wait to have is this new test. It's, as I understand it, it's coming soon. I think Abbott has it, where you can test somebody quickly and right away determine whether they have the antibody. In other words, whether they've already had the disease, because those are the people that ought to be, you know, pushed to the front line. And I'm hoping that we can get that test here soon as well.
You mentioned here, you know, a handful of times in our conversation when you and I talked yesterday as well, how many times, you know, you've talked to the White House, what, 4 or 5 times just this week or in the past week? I find probably four or five times a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. You and I talked about it yesterday, but that's interesting you bring that up, because, you know, it seems like 10 years ago now, but you took a lot of heat over siding with the president on impeachment. But do you now look back on that decision and think, if I would have gone the other way, my calls wouldn't be getting answered, and some of these things that I'm able to help get Ohio and, you know, get cleared up with the Trump administration. And again, I know these are two separate things, but I know you have to pick and choose your moments and when you're critical or when you go against the president. But you now look back and think, wow, had I gone against the president, I'd be getting, my calls wouldn't be getting answered, and some of these things wouldn't be getting done.
Yeah. Well, there's no question he's been helpful to Ohio, and he mentioned in his press briefing last night that, you know, we had worked together on this issue of getting the gowns, the 2.3 million gowns from Cardinal Health out to the stockpile, and, you know, they're in New York right now helping people, and so he was helpful. So, yeah, there's no question it's useful to have a constructive working relationship, you know, with the administration, by the way, whether it's a Democrat or Republican administration. And I've tried to be respectful of various administrations. On the impeachment thing, I didn't think that issue rose to the level of high crimes. And I didn't think that the American people should be told, you know, this guy's out of here, you don't have a chance to vote for him one way or the other, because we were in the middle of an election, still are. So I just didn't think in that case that was the right thing to do. But you're right. If I had gone the other way, it'd be very hard to have the kind of relationship that you want to have. But it's, you know, politics is like anything else. It's like your family or like business. You know, you speak up and let your voice be heard. They aren't always happy with me, but you try to be constructive, and you try to be respectful, and you say, I think you said it well there. You kind of choose your battles, you know, because my job is to represent Ohio and get things done. And whether it's legislative or whether it's some of these projects we're talking about, you know, it's not to give speeches and get on cable TV and throw out the red meat. Other people can do that. That's fine. But that's not the job that you're hired to do as an elected official.
It's amazing to think the impeachment conversation was just 2 months ago, and it was the biggest thing. And it was, you know, dominated all of the news cycles. And now, you know, we're just in a crisis that no one has ever seen before.
Yeah, you're so right, Sherry. I mean, it seems like it was Jason said a year ago. It seems like it was 5 years ago to me. But, and there'll probably be something else before the election. But this issue of the coronavirus is going to be with us for a while. I mean, unfortunately, based on my briefing we just had from Dr. Fauci, I was on with him and a bunch of other senators. You know, nobody knows what the timing is. We know that through the next couple of months, it's a critical time. And one thing he said that was interesting this morning, and I'm not, you know, repeating anything that's confidential, but he said the New York experience, as bad as it is, will be a model that people can look at and say, okay, how do we do better? And how do we get, you know, around the corner on this? In other words, at some point, you're going to have less infections every day in New York. And it could happen relatively soon, he's saying. The hospitalizations and the ICU people out of an ICU and the fatalities will lag behind that, because you think about it, if there are less infections, well, the person who was infected 3 weeks ago is now the person who's hospitalized. But as that data starts to come out, it will give us the ability with good testing. That's why I keep coming back to testing. You got to have the testing, but the ability to at least have some sense of how this thing is working and when it is safe to say, okay, you know, let's start getting back to life as normal. And New York being at the front end of this will probably provide some of that data. So my hope is that what happens in New York is not as bad as some are projecting. And there's a lot of PPE going there now. There's a lot of testing. There's a lot of ventilators and so on. But when it's, you know, 3 or 4 weeks from now, that will be kind of the model that the rest of the country is going to look at to see how this thing progresses.
Have you had just a personal conversation with Trump during the crisis? Have you been able to talk with him?
I talked to him yesterday. Yeah, directly, yeah. I asked for his help on a couple of these things. And it was about a couple of Ohio needs that we have, and he was responsive. And again, he mentioned that in the press conference later that we'd spoken.
Uh-huh.
But I find that he is willing to break through the bureaucracy and get things done. That's kind of his style anyway. You know, he believes that if there's that's got to happen, he's kind of got a private sector focus or mentality about it. So I found him to be responsive. And I think he also is watching what we're doing in Ohio. I think, again, as I said earlier, Ohio has been a leading state in terms of the social distancing and, you know, trying to get more testing and so on. And so I think he's interested in what we're doing in Ohio, and he's trying to be helpful.
I assume that a conversation like that doesn't happen if you follow Mitt Romney on impeachment.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I can't say that, but it's easier if you have a working relationship and a constructive relationship. And there's a guy who works for him, who's the assistant to the president and the coordinator for a lot of these efforts. His name is Peter mm-hmm. Navarro, and he's been very helpful too. He was helpful on the issues we talked about, whether it's the Cardinal health issue or the UC health issue or the Battelle masks. So there's somebody within the White House who I have a relationship with and have worked with on other projects back in more normal times. And so you use those relationships to try to help during a time of crisis.
Any, totally lightening it up a little bit, anything in particular you've been found that you're fun to do on your downtime, if there is such thing as downtime?
Much downtime, but one thing that's been fun for me is spending more time with Jane. You know, I'm in D.C. usually during the week, and she's here. She's chair of Children's Hospital and busy, and you know, she's got a lot going on. But it's been great to spend more time with my wife, and then our kids. We got one here, seeing him more, but we've got three of them, and we're in constant communication. We have this, you know, group text thing going. And that's been great. I mean, family, you realize in a crisis like this how important family and friends, faith, you know, some of the mm-hmm. basics that you get kind of away from during our busy lives. So I'm on the phone pretty much every day doing a lot of videos. Did a teletown hall did two teletown halls yesterday, one with seniors with the ARP and one in the northeast part of Ohio, just that we put together. And we're trying to stay in touch with people. We've got another Facebook live town hall coming up. We're trying to figure out how to stay in touch with people to let them know, you know, how the federal legislation affects them in particular. That's one of the things that people are really curious about. You know, how do they get their check? How is a small business? Do you get this loan that converts into a grant? You know, how do you get the unemployment insurance? So we're spending a lot of time doing that. And then second is, you know, working on these projects, trying to get the PPE into Ohio, get more testing in Ohio. Get the ventilators moving and all the things that we talked about today.
Yeah. Sherry, you have any other questions?
I don't, but I do agree. It's like this time with our families, like even though that's tons of work and there are like all these, you know, meetings on the computer, but it is like at night and you're with your family, and that might not have been true before.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, have you guys checked out talking about Procter & Gamble, hashtag distance dance?
With the YouTube star, right? The TikTok,
yeah,
with her TikTok.
The TikToker. Charlie D'Amelio?
Yes, that Alex and I quickly had to become familiar with those terms, people. I was like, ooh, how old are we? But that has been a big thing. I know I've since then, of course, I've asked, you know, my friends with teenagers. And yes, that's a real thing.
Yeah, so I'm talking
providing
to the,
food for
to
people.
The Procter & Gamble CEO and I are having this, you know, conversation, obviously very serious about all this and all the stuff they're doing and what they could do more of. And he says, you know, I got to tell you something else we're doing. We our communications people started this hashtag distance dance thing. He said, we've had over 2 billion views. And that was as of a few days ago. So probably more by now. But anyway, so there is
wait, you used the word period, billion, there is, billion with a B.
Yeah. Billion. Billion.
Oh
B.
Yeah.
So anyway, it must be something that so I checked it out. And yeah, so there's some.
Oh,
things
wait,
that
did
are
you do a dance?
Happening.
Did you share a dance?
I'm not going to reveal that. Luckily, you know, it can be done in private now because no one can film me easily. So.
All right, I'm going to leave it with.
I did
know,
move
that's
a little
something
bit.
I would want to see. I think you should put that out there.
Yeah.
Great stuff, Senator Portman. Really appreciate the time. And, you know, you've been so excited. You're always accessible, but, you know, just, you know, talking yesterday and, you know, keeping the updates coming. So, really appreciate you taking the time with us today here on the podcast.
Well, hey, thanks for what you guys are doing. I said that earlier, but Sherry, both of you guys have been writing about this issue and giving people information. And, you know, people are really hungry for facts and, you know, how to get through this better. And it could be tough because it's going to be another couple months, I think, of, you know, really not being able to have a normal life. But on the other hand, so many great stories out there of people doing heroic things and volunteering and helping out. We got people in our neighborhood, you know, who are picking up groceries for seniors. We have a friend who's making masks at home on a little sewing machine with kids who are out of school and, you know, giving them to the children's hospitals. I mean, there's just example after example of people doing things, you know, to step up during this crisis. So together we'll get through this thing. And
yeah,
on the other end of it, maybe we'll continue to remember the importance of what we talked about earlier, family and friends and faith and things that are really important in life, and get back to growing this economy and giving people opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks so much again. It was really enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks, guys. Stay healthy.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye. Oh, wow. Great stuff from Senator Portman. Really appreciate him coming on. What do you think, Cher?
You know, it was such a serious conversation. We had a couple laughs, too, which is always good. But I think back to other times that I've interviewed him, like about, you know, political things or like, and this is it's such a different time. I definitely appreciated him thanking us. But
yeah.
You know, like we don't do this to for someone to say thank you. And I never expect that. And it's not usually, you know, the reaction that we get. So that was nice. But I hope he's right and that people are reading everything and that we are providing a service.
Well, you know, it reminds me of a story. Well, not a story, but, you know, after I wrote my Going Home to Trump Country column last October, I believe it was September. Actually, Senator Portman called me just to say, hey, it was spot on. I really liked your piece. I'm not calling for any attention here. I just being a senator, having spent a lot of time over there, I think you really brought a lot of perspective having been from there. And, you know, that meant a lot. That, you know, just he called me and said, hey, I really liked your column. And I hadn't talked to him in probably a year or so. I also will say this about Senator Portman. You know, I was critical of him on the impeachment. I thought that he should have abstained from any of the votes because of his involvement with the Ukraine caucus. But here's someone who handles criticism really well. Pretty thick skin, gets it, understands it. And so when he says to us that, hey, appreciates what we're doing, and much like when we had Senator Brown on, I think they both value they both respect the First Amendment and they value the freedom of the press. And as we all know, not all American politicians do. So,
no, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah. Speaking of freedom of the press, Sherry, you and I were talking about this, and you know, our editor, executive editor Burl Love, who we had on the podcast two episodes ago, put out a really heartfelt, meaningful post on Facebook last night, talking about I just called it up, but like talking about the important work that we do, holding leaders accountable, giving a voice to the powerless, documenting history in real time. And you know, he talked about our parent company requiring us all to take 3 weeks of unpaid furlough in the second quarter, which just started yesterday. And then he thanked people for subscribing and asked for folks to subscribe.
You know, and I took that to heart. I saw that post, and he and I talked a little bit about it. And, you know, I appreciate him putting it out there. I hate the idea of asking people to subscribe. You know, I want the work to stand on its own, but it is a very important part of our business model now. And I really hope, I definitely don't think when I sit now at my kitchen table or stand, you know, in my yellow guest room, I don't think about, you know, the money side of the Inquirer. I don't want to have to, and we never really do, but you know, making sure that it continues is important. And I just want to provide, that's our job, is to provide information to people. And that's what I think about. And you know, it's been like three stories a day. We've worked every single weekend day for sure for like 3 weeks, and that none of that matters. It's just about making sure everybody knows what they need to know. And, you know, all of these press conferences and monitoring them. And then it's that outcome that you see there. And I hope that people do value it because I care when I'm doing it. And that's why I'm doing it.
Well, you know, and I saw a post from a retired suburban police chief. I think it was maybe Middletown, talking about, and it was great to hear it from, you know, someone who's not a journalist, but he was tweeting about how, hey, local journalism is really important. And it's not the same as what you hear being said on the national cable networks. So there is a difference. And I've talked about it. You and I have talked about it. Earl's talked about it, like that, you know, we're here covering the things that matter most to you in your front and backyard. And, you know, we are different than Fox News and CNN and MSNBC and the New York Times and Washington Post. None of those folks are covering Cincinnati City Hall and Hamilton County government, and Claremont County government, and your townships, and you know, holding our local officials accountable for what they say and do. And those are the people who are making the decisions that most affect our daily lives from a government standpoint, with our tax dollars, whether our trash is picked up, whether our streets are safe, whether our fires get put out, you know, our water system works right, our toilets flush. Like, these are all decisions made that are very critical to our daily functioning. They're all made on the local level. And, you know, I don't mean to sound so cliche about it, but I mean, you know, people ask me sometimes, like, hey, would you love to go on and work for, you know, Washington Post someday or whatever? And like, no, really don't. Like, I'm very, very passionate about Cincinnati and passionate about local journalism. And this is where I wanted to be. And here we are, and we're doing it.
Both Alex and I agree with that. I mean, our dream was to go to New York or DC someday, a long time ago when we came here. But we do think, you know, our jobs matter, and we're able to affect our community. And like, that's important to, you know, how we feel about things. And we love living here. Love living here. And I love that we have a ballet and a symphony and all of the things that we have downtown. And you know, this urban core, amazing parks here. And so when I'm covering all of these things, like, I know we just have an amazing community, and I can't wait to see, you know, how it weathers this storm and we get through this from a state level down to like a local level, and chronicling that. We are chronicling it in real time, and you're going to start seeing bigger stories later. We're already starting to talk about that, but just like these are right now, it's a lot of news you can use.
And absolutely
in the day to day. But like when we did 7 days of heroin, you know, really what the opiate crisis meant to our community. I think you'll see definitely a lot more things about that. I have, an email sitting in my inbox now about that kind of reporting and what we're going to be doing about that. And so I hope people are willing to subscribe. And every time I see someone subscribe, you know, and those links in our story, I appreciate it. And, you know, and all of this coverage has been provided for free about, you know, the pandemic. And, you know, that's a real commitment from a company, you know, that's struggling, like, just with this advertising to get through what's probably going to be, you know, a downturn here. But they're still like, well, we do have this model of a paywall, but this news is super important to you, and that's what we do.
Yep, that's exactly right. And on that note, you know, would really encourage people to subscribe. If you already are a subscriber, which I know our listeners are incredibly highly engaged news consumers. Otherwise, I think that, you know, the commitment you've shown to listen to, you know, 45-hour-long podcast each week, it really shows that you're passionate about it and you want and hunger for local news. So totally my assumption is that probably many, many of you listeners are already subscribers. If you're not, you know, right now you can go to cincinnati.com/subscribe, and we have $3 for 3 months of all access digital subscription. It's a 90% discount right now. Or you could do the one I like is you get a little bit of all platforms, and it's the Sunday print delivery. So for 99 cents a week for the first 3 months, you can get the Sunday paper delivered to your house, but then, you know, 24/7 access to digital access. And, you know, this is a new world we're living in terms of, you know, it's like the old world. It's just, you used to subscribe to your newspaper that was delivered to you, or you pick up at UDF, or, you know, you buy it there, or Starbucks. Now it's just, you just pay for that same thing, but you pay for it on your phone or on your laptop.
And there's also, when you're a subscriber, there's an app where you see what the actual paper looks like, and you can kind of scroll through it. Like, I think back in, like, the Sunday morning of, like, when was the difference of me walking out to the sidewalk, which it still comes and still sits there, and me just laying in bed and being like, I can just scroll through what it looks like, and I don't have to go outside.
Yeah. So, cincinnati.com/subscribe. Check it out. Always got good deals on that stuff. I think with the discounts we run, it's absolutely, certainly worth it. I think it's worth it for the full price, but yeah, I may be biased. So, but yeah, there's always something there, and there's always a nice mix of, if you want to do a Sunday print or even all week print and all access digital. Actually, even if you're a print subscriber now, you're automatically have all access digital subscription as well. So anyway, wow, another.
So I think we need to have a special shout out to our families. Who knew they could be this quiet for this long? I did not.
Well, I got to give a special shout out to another family, because my friend, the Georges, the George family of Finneytown. I went on Facebook last week because my boys literally, I think it was Thursday, and my kids, I was trying to work, and I just decided, I ended up taking all last week off except for the podcast. And I was going to take the week off anyway, and we were going to go down to South Carolina. But I was trying to do a little bit of work on Thursday, and my kids just, and we have a pretty small house, and you just can't get away from it. And so I took a video of one of their fights and put it on Facebook, and just said, how in the world can you work at home like this? And I know there are other people struggling out there or whatever. No one's fault, obviously. You know, it's just the world that we're living in right now. And it turns out, like, my mother-in-law offered me to work out of their office basement their office in their basement at their house in Springfield Township. And then our other, my friends, the Georges, my friend Matt is a teacher in Winton Woods, and he took their two kids and went to Michigan because they have a family cottage up there on the lake. And then Sandra is a social worker, so she has to still go to work every day. So she's just like, if you want to use our house and our dining room table, come on. So it's just up the hill from where I live, and it's dead silent. The birds are chirping, and it's pretty delightful.
Which I sorry, think a long lot of story people short. Are, I know, found, but a lot I found of a good place to work. In like that.
I know. See, know, that's another example. Another small example of, you know, what Senator Portman was talking about. All these little examples of, you know, people reaching out and offering something. We had a neighbor, and it, I almost feel guilty about it. It's like we had a neighbor, one of our neighbors, the O'Malley's, made us a big thing of lasagna the night. Hey, we just want to make dinner for you.
And, it was, and that's like some of the good things to come out of this.
Absolutely. Our other neighbors, the Janigans, like stopped by and brought us a big, big thing of Clorox wipes. I'm like, hey, were we out of those? She's like, no.
Like just, gold now.
Bethany's just like, no, like just people doing nice things for people. I'm like, oh, no. Oh, that's what that is. I'm kidding. Anyway, how's the neighborhood? How's your neighborhood?
It's good. It's nice and quiet. You know, the kids are go outside and ride their bikes. And you know, it's nice. And, you know, we live in Oak Hill School District. So the kids, you know, I know are spending the mornings online. It's their teachers have done an amazing job of putting all their lessons online so the kids can just click on them. So I mean, there is a little bit of normalcy as much as it can be of like there is some schooling going on here.
Yeah, amazing the pretty quick turnaround on how these teachers have quickly adjusted to get things online. And you know, like my teacher, or my kid's first grade teacher, did a video, like read a story to the students on a video today. He was watching it this morning. And yeah, I think that's the new world we're living in for the rest of this school year. And I think any time now that they're going to announce that schools are closing in Ohio, Jerry, for the rest of the year.
It's hard to see a way that they're not going to with all of the, you know, conversations we're having about peaks and things like that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, great stuff today. Appreciate everyone listening again. Appreciate everyone subscribing. And, you know, we're making it happen on the podcast, and we will be back next week. So catch you then.
Bye, Jay. Bye, Silentville.